Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Huckenberry. So where do you get your inspiration? Does it take a little chemical assistance, like the suddenly legal marijuana in Oregon, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.? We're going to talk a little about the politics of those votes and other votes this week. Does reading obituaries give you ideas for screenplays, novels? How about songs? Well, songwriter Yasha Hoffman found inspiration in the obits and turned it into an album titled Afterneath. It's a little like Death Cab for Cutie meets Jeff Buckley. It's actually pleasant, even upbeat, so stay tuned for that. But first, nearly 30 years ago, in December of 1984, people in Bhopal, India, awoke to the smell of noxious fumes coming from an industrial plant that was making their community among the most prosperous in their region of India. Methyl isocyanate, a precursor for pesticides made by the plant's owner, Union Carbide, had leaked. 40 tons killed about 4,000 people almost immediately. And the subsequent death toll of what has been called the worst industrial accident in history eventually reached 15,000. The plant site remains contaminated to this day. Eight people were found guilty, including Warren Anderson, CEO of Union Carbide, in absentia. His death at 92 was confirmed this week by public records nearly a month after he died in Vero Beach, Florida, a place where pesticides are used to keep gardens attractive and lawns and golf courses green. Anderson's role in the Bhopal disaster is the subject of a new film called Bhopal, A Prayer for Rain, which opens in New York tomorrow. Martin Sheen plays Anderson, the hardworking dreamer dedicated to the idea of making the world better through chemistry, any place in the world.
When I came here 10 years ago, no one believed that we could build this factory here, and we did it, and now we're here to stay. Together, we can survive this drought. Remember, we're not just Carbide, we are Union Carbide, united in our efforts to build a better future for everyone. Yes, we have limited resources, true, but we also have our minds and our hearts and our hands. So, gentlemen, let's use them.
The sentiments sound true, but the events leading up to the accident are fictionalized in Bhopal, A Prayer for Rain, which also stars Misha Barton as a fictional American journalist and Cal Penn as Motwani, a journalist in Bhopal. Together, they fight to hold Union Carbide accountable to the people of Bhopal. Actor Cal Penn joins me now. Cal, thanks for being part of this.
Thanks for having me.
This is a very personal story, I would think.
It is, yeah. You know, I knew of the story growing up, just anecdotally almost, and then in college, of course, in environmental studies classes and whatnot, it comes up. But I didn't really get to experience the depth of it until I sat down with the writer-director, Ravi Kumar, who is from the region around Bhopal. And this was a passion project for him, really sitting down and understanding the complexity of why he wanted to tell a story like this. And then, frankly, going from, you know, I've had the blessing of doing these sort of broad comedies, and I love them. But it also, you know, as I get older, especially, I want to mix those up with things that kind of make me think and that challenge me a little more as an artist.
And the notion of India has reversed a little bit. I mean, it's an industrial power right now. It was not in 1984 in the same way. There's a prosperity in India from industrial development of one kind or another. How do Indians view the Bhopal disaster?
Yeah, it's a good question. It was interesting to see. I mean, I think in the 1980s, certainly it was an emerging economy. Now, you know, no doubt China, India, and Brazil have all emerged and are powerhouses in their own right. When we were shooting the movie, there were definitely sensitivities. You know, you would hear whispers from folks in India saying, what kind of story are you telling? Which perspective are you approaching it from? And as an American actor, I thought that was particularly interesting because I know that talking to the director, his goal was to tell as complex a story as he could. So, you know, not placing blame on corporate greed or on government corruption or on environmental law, but really taking them all together.
Sheen is playing a character who almost comes out of the early 20th century, this kind of industrial America can do anything, technology can do anything. But he, of course, is speaking in India, a place where, you know, those arguments are persuasive, but would not necessarily be thought of in the same way in the United States at that time.
I think that's right. I think there's a difference in the industrialization, particularly I think, you know, India liberalized its markets after this particular disaster. So there were things that I'm certainly not an expert on Indian economics by any means. But in the research, it was interesting to see that there's a lot more foreign capital that's there now that didn't exist before. And that work ethic, you know, that I think Martin's character describes so eloquently is not something that necessarily went away. And that's particularly fascinating to me because the subject matter that we're talking about, you know, these things still happen. BP is the most recent sort of big publicized example of an industrial disaster. And so these things do keep happening. I think the hope from a lot of the folks we've talked to is that there should be some checks and balances, particularly as economies emerge and industrialization takes place, to assure that we can prevent them as best as possible.
Speaking of checks and balances, journalists are very convenient characters for filmmakers because they, you know, tell the story and they're the kind of going after the evil character. But do you believe that journalists in this particular case had an impact, can have an impact in the story? Do they have an impact that's real to you?
I absolutely think journalists have an impact. You know, the character that I play is actually loosely based on a real guy. So I play this absurd gossip columnist who wears really loud shirts and is very boisterous and prints really absurd headlines, which is why nobody in the town trusts him. And over the arc of the film, you realize that Motwani, my character, actually cares very deeply for his community, and he does have really the only lead on this impending disaster. Tries to warn people, nobody believes him because, you know, he's told so many lies, as classic Boy Who Cried Wolf story. But in looking into the reality of who this guy was, he still is, by the way, a journalist in Bhopal and others. You know, this disaster took place way before, forget the digital divide, but even before reliable electricity and phone service in this part of India, or this part of the world, frankly. And so having local journalists, especially whether they were known as gossip columnists or not, in the minutes and hours and days after something like this is pivotal in both keeping history and telling the stories of exactly what happened, how many people were affected, and why.
And the fact that Bhopal is still contaminated today, what does that mean to you?
Of course, nothing short of a tragedy, right? I think the sheer volume of issues that, you know, go into something like this. I briefly mentioned, of course, the corporate greed, but there are also all these loopholes, these legal loopholes, frankly, that Union Carbide and Dow Chemical have been able to kind of slip through. Immense government corruption and issues with enforcement and accountability in India, not just in the 1980s, but even today. And it's a tragedy because the site has not been fully cleaned up, certainly. You know, these chemicals are seeping into the groundwater. There's evidence that that's contaminating folks who are still born today. And I never like to politicize films, just sort of personal preference. I love the ability to play different characters. But Amnesty International has been a partner with us on this film, and seeing their various campaigns, not just about Bhopal, but corporate justice or environmental justice overall. I think, look, if there's any movement that a small film like this can even bring to the conversation about accountability, prevention of these sorts of atrocities in the future, I think it's a good thing, because I think it's a shame that things haven't been cleaned up, particularly the way that the Indian economy is emerging so beautifully. You know, you'd hope that there are those checks and balances in the future.
Actor Cal Penn plays Motwani, a journalist in Bhopal, in the film Bhopal, A Prayer for Rain, about the worst industrial disaster in history that's still causing death and injury in Bhopal today. Cal Penn, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Some rough waters for the Russian economy right now. A decision by the Russian Central Bank to limit its support of the ruble with its foreign reserves caused a further decline on world markets, 25% drop since the beginning of the year. The declining price of oil has a major impact on Russian hard currency. Has this crisis revealed one of Russia's more closely guarded state secrets? How much are international sanctions over Ukraine and Crimea hurting? Ryan Chilcoat joins us. He's a reporter for Bloomberg TV in London. Ryan, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So have we revealed here some pain inside Russia?
Yeah, we have. So there's a few things going on, as you pointed out there. One is the drop in oil. That has a direct price effect on the ruble. There was actually a Russian bank out today that said that for every $10 the oil price drops, That costs the ruble to dollar exchange rate a couple rubles. So that's one thing going on. But that's not the only thing. Another issue is capital flight, basically Russians not trusting the ruble, so moving their money into other currencies, whether they're oligarchs or just people on the street. And then finally, there's the issue of sanctions, which I know the Obama administration likes to point out that they think that their sanctions are working. And one of the examples they give is the ruble, but it's not just the sanctions that's affecting the ruble.
You've spent a lot of time in Russia. What would you think the consumer view of all of this is? 25% plummet of the ruble is going to cause some inflation inside Russia.
Yeah, you know, it's difficult for us to get our head around, perhaps in the United States, but Russians think a lot about their exchange rate. It's specifically the ruble rate to the dollar. There was a time, in fact, in Russia when many prices were quoted in dollars, and you just sort of, as the exchange rate changed, paid that changing amount until the Russian government basically banned that about a decade ago. But they're very fixated on everywhere you go, you'll see foreign exchange points and you'll see that exchange. And they basically see that exchange rate as a measure of the well-being of the economy. And when they see it go as it has to 46 today from, you know, on average, you know, low 30s over the last couple of years, that really alarms them. Plus, of course, it fuels inflation, like you were talking about, because so many of the things they buy are imported. So the importers have to, you know, raise prices.
Even if the imports have been reduced under sanctions and Putin's response to sanctions, you know, it's a wealth effect issue. People feel as though their rubles are worth less. They can't, you know, run away and get as much money as they thought. You know, one other thing that I wanted to ask you about is, you know, it's talked about in the United States that when the dollar plummets, it makes U.S. exports cheaper and that makes us more competitive. Yeah. Russia's in a particularly weird situation because most of their exports are energy, so it doesn't have the same effect.
Well, you know, interestingly, actually, that is one good thing for the Russians. So they sell an awful lot of oil, right? This is the world's largest energy producer in dollars. And their costs don't change as the exchange rate changes. So actually, they do gain, if you think about it, particularly when you think about the budget, because the budget gets about half of its money from oil and gas. So they do win there. But I think the overall minus is the population gets really nervous, and the Kremlin doesn't want to see that. And you have inflation. So on the whole, they would probably prefer not to see the ruble fall too far.
How much of a blip is this? How sustainable is it? Will we be looking at this same sort of price of the ruble a month from now, 2 months from now?
Well, look, no one thought it was going to go this far, right? There's now talk that perhaps it'll settle around 50 to the dollar. But if you'd asked me a month ago, I would never say we would have gotten to where we are.
I won't ask you for any predictions. Don't you worry about that. Ryan Chilcutt, reporter with Bloomberg TV on the Russian economy. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Thank you.
On Tuesday, Tennessee joined Texas as something of a legal laboratory for confronting the Supreme Court's doctrine on legalized abortion. The state's Amendment 1 gives the state legislature authority to regulate abortion in ways that might make it to the Supreme Court, as is already the case in Texas. Historically, Tennessee has had more liberal rules on abortion compared to its neighbors in the South. A CDC survey found that about a quarter of the abortions performed in Tennessee in 2010 were for women who lived outside of the state. Mae Beavers is a Republican senator from the Mount Juliet area outside of Nashville. Senator Beavers, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on to explain.
How much of this is a corrective, a sort of public health issue, and how much of this is an attempt to do what is going on in Texas right now, really pushing the envelope on what regulations shall be permitted for abortions?
Well, first of all, I think it's an attempt to make abortion, since we have them with Roe versus Wade, safe for women. You know, we have seen horror stories of the filth in some of the abortion clinics and things like that. So we want to clean that up. We want to make sure that these abortion clinics have to be licensed, have to have health inspections. We want to make sure the patient has informed consent before they get an abortion. Just the things that we expect right now when we go in for any medical procedure. Those are some of the things that we're looking at.
Is it your view that you don't want to do anything to make it more difficult for a woman to get an abortion?
I want to make it possible for a woman to be fully informed of what she is about to do, just like I am informed when I go into the hospital for any other medical procedure. I want to make sure that the women go to a place that is safe, that is clean, and that she realizes what she's doing.
Would you suggest that the impact of these laws in Tennessee would be to reduce the number of clinics, of abortion procedure centers in the state of Tennessee? Would that be the intent in some way, or possibly the consequence?
I guess one possible consequence is that when a woman has all of the information, she could decide against having an abortion. Right now in Tennessee, a woman can come across our state line from another state that has more restrictions and have an abortion and return home that day without even thinking about what she's doing. You know, even if you go in for, you know, any other procedure, you have time to think about it. You have informed consent on how it might affect you with maybe your medical problems. These women do not have that in Tennessee right now. Therefore, one in four women in Tennessee who are receiving abortions here are from out of state. We're a go-to state when it comes to abortion.
Senator Beavers, do you understand how it might sound cruel for you to say that women are crossing a state line to have an abortion without even thinking about what they're doing? I mean, it's certainly the case that for any woman, an abortion is a serious procedure that certainly involves all kinds of personal consequences that they must have thought about, right?
Well, possibly, and I'm not sure. They're in a situation where I think it's hard for them to think, you know, about all of the little details of what they're doing. And I think that's why they need to be fully informed before they have the procedure.
You know, extending the Affordable Care Act, the Medicaid procedures for the Affordable Care Act would certainly have allowed more people in Tennessee to get surgically appropriate abortion procedures. Why did Tennessee choose not to do that?
Tennessee has not joined the expanded Medicaid program under Obamacare. It's a decision that we made. I'm personally against Obamacare, and the expansion means that, yes, we would get more federal money, but in the long run, it would be in our lap after a few years.
All right, Senator Beavers, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Mae Beavers is a Republican state senator in the Tennessee legislature. The question of legalized marijuana use will confront the federal government's resistance to recreational pot as a result of a couple of votes this week. Oregon joined Washington State in legalizing pot. So did Washington, D.C. And because D.C. is not a state, and some statehood advocates would say because it is a colony ruled by a Capitol Hill dictatorship, Congress can actually overrule the D.C. pot law. So does the reefer revolution begin on Constitution Avenue all of a sudden? Joining me to discuss this is Ethan Nadelman, who is the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Ethan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on, John.
So let's talk about the D.C. thing first, because there are a couple of interesting things nationally here. Does this force the issue? I mean, with the Republicans controlling House and Senate, it would seem to me almost an inescapable temptation for the Republicans to immediately overrule this law. And then suddenly there's a political battle brewing right there in Capitol Hill.
Yeah, I'll tell you, it could, but I think it's unlikely for a few reasons. The first one, John, is that the Washington, D.C. initiative, which won with an incredible 70% on Election Day, it doesn't go as far as Colorado and Washington went 2 years ago or as Oregon and Alaska did a couple days ago. It doesn't set up a system of taxing and regulating marijuana and allowing it people to buy it in stores. It simply expands the right of decriminalization, essentially, the ability of people to possess and to grow their own. So in that sense, it's not going to be as in Congress's face as one would expect. Now, that said, this initiative was done very much, I wouldn't say in collaboration, but in sort of close coordination with members of the D.C. City Council. And right now, as I understand it, a majority of D.C. City Council members favor a system of legalizing marijuana and taxing and regulating it. So if they basically said to us, normally they don't like ballot initiatives, you know, they feel, you know, that they're being overwhelmed by Congress on the one hand, they don't like initiatives on the other. But in this case, they said, look, if you guys can win this with an overwhelming margin, that'll give us the political legitimacy to move forward on tax and regulation. Pass some legislation in D.C. and then challenge Congress at that point. I think that's the moment when we'll really see Congress have to make some decisions, because that'll be the moment when they'll be confronted with having legal marijuana outlets in the nation's capital.
Does this confront or actually relieve some tension between the citizens of D.C. and law enforcement, who have always had a problem with the overrepresentation of African Americans in jails and in the sort of arrest reports?
Well, I'll tell you, it was an interesting marijuana initiative in that this was the first one in the country among the many I've been involved in where racial justice and the racial disproportionality of marijuana arrests played a major role, right? So people got galvanized, people got educated. And I think at this point, we're probably going to see the D.C. police really stepping back. I mean, the D.C. City Council passed a pretty good, in fact, a very good decriminalization bill earlier this year. This initiative takes it a step further. So I think the cops are still going to try to find ways to, you know, arrest and get their hands on young people, especially young men of color in the nation's capital. But I think we're going to see a little better relationship between the police and young citizens in D.C. than we have in the past.
All right, let's go out west. Do federal border agents patrol the border between Oregon and Washington and try to enforce the crossing of state lines to sell marijuana, since that's the only jurisdiction here?
In fact, I got to tell you, it's sort of funny. One of the things that happened was the Oregonian, which is the leading paper in Oregon and Portland, one of the arguments they used in editorializing in favor of Oregon legalizing marijuana was they said, look, at this point, people are driving from Portland just over the border to Vancouver, Washington, which is, I don't know the area that well, but 15 minutes away or something, half an hour away. Why should Oregonians be paying taxes to Washington State when they buy their marijuana? Why don't they just pay the taxes here? So I think that the Washington-Oregon border has been and is going to be very chill. That's not going to be the issue. I think the only place you're going to see problems is when you start talking about borders with states like Idaho, where there have been reports of the police actually profiling cars with Washington State or Colorado license plates and pulling them over simply because that they have that license plate. It's not been a major issue, but we're hearing some of that going on.
But does the Pacific Northwest become an agricultural center for the production of pot in the same way that illegally, Humboldt County is down in California?
I don't think so. I mean, let's remember, it's not as if we're creating a whole new industry here. What's essentially going on is the transformation of what has been a marijuana industry worth tens of billions of dollars that's been entirely unregulated, underground, oftentimes, you know, with criminal organizations playing a role. And what we're now doing is moving that industry into a legally regulated world where we'll once again have an industry worth tens of billions of dollars, but it will be paying taxes. The criminal element will be increasingly diminished. Consumers will have much better knowledge of what they're getting. So I don't think we're going to see a great boom. What we're going to see is stuff that was previously underground emerging above ground. That's the transformation that we're seeking. That's what we're trying to do here, not to build a new industry, but to stop the ineffective prohibition and the backward criminalization and all the harms of criminalization.
All right, enough of your activism advocacy business right now. How old are you, Ethan?
I am 57.
Okay. How many kids do you have?
One.
One. All right. So give me some advice here. What do I tell my kids about pot now that it's legal in Alaska, it's legal in D.C., it's legal in Oregon, Washington, Colorado?
Well, John, how old
is it over? Is it over? My kid, teenage, four teenagers, pal. Okay.
Okay. Okay. So you got to work your way through this teenage thing. Here's my advice to you,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
essentially is the lesson to your kids about marijuana is the same more or less as the message about alcohol. Right. Which is that marijuana is not something, you know, people should not be doing this at a young age. Right. That if you get involved in this at a very young age, it's much more likely you're going to get in trouble. It's going to screw you up in school and all sorts of things like that. But that if, you know, when you're older, you do it responsibly. Don't do it in a stupid way. Don't do that waking and baking and going to school and think you can learn anything when you're high. Don't get behind the wheel of a car when you're high. And if they say, well, the fact that they made it legal, Dad, doesn't that mean it's okay now? You say, wait a second. You know something? Cigarettes aren't legal. Doesn't mean they're okay. Alcohol's legal for adults. Doesn't mean it's okay for teenagers. This law on marijuana, it's for 21 and over.
Ethan, thanks a lot. You've performed a public service, at least for me.
Thank you, John. Ethan, thank you very much.
Ethan Nettleman is the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. When you are dead, you are dead. And of course, there are various ideas of immortality that range from the religious to the sentimental memories that all live on. The New York Times confers a certain immortality, as it did in this obituary for Jack Kevorkian, the helpful doctor, hey, can I hold the door to oblivion for you, pal, who at 83 made it into the obit section on June 3rd, 2011.
When the light dims and your sight dims and you're ready to go, anesthesia and the seizures.
I guess I'm trying to see the world from through the eyes of someone who has just recently passed away and whose spirit is in the air.
Yasha Hoffman, speaking there, has come up with something to add to the notion of immortality. He's a former freelance obit writer. He's also a songwriter. He wrote this Kevorkian song, Mercy Machine. He also writes the Scan column on science and the arts for the New York Times. This collection of songs is called Afterneath, musical gems inspired by, and in some cases literally, the obits themselves.
Yeah, I was writing these occasional freelance obituaries of scientists for the New York Times. And then I was also trying to write songs, working on my third album as a songwriter, and finding right. myself just coming up short when it came to character and story and narrative. Like, everything from my life felt like a little too familiar. But when I would try to invent something from whole cloth, it would just seem forced. And so I was looking around, you know, like screenplays and various source material, just hoping to open things up a little bit. And I think at one point, my editor at the time sent me a book that was a collection of all the obituaries of the last year of the New York Times. And I opened it up and I was just like, this is it.
All right, well, let's see how that works with the song, The Atom Bomb.
As the sky pulled up inward, she was pressed to the sand, like an ocean above her, God's left hand. When it hit Hiroshima, she was out of her heart. So she boarded a steamer, the red, red star.
It's about a woman named Joan Hinton, who was mm-hmm. a Manhattan Project physicist at a very young age, in her 20s. And she got so disillusioned with the work that she had done after the bombs were dropped. She left the United States and she went to China.
So she worked for the chairman, and she lived on a farm, and she raised up her children to fear the bomb. The reactors are humming as she plays violin. When the big one is coming, she keeps on breathing.
So her story, it felt so rich with so much, not just her own life, but with this whole arc of the 20th century.
The 20th century is where all these characters lived and died. And as you accumulate each one of these songs and each one of these obits, does the century emerge in some way?
Yeah, you know, to my surprise, I felt like it did. Like, at first, I was assuming this would end up being a sort of morbid exercise, because all of these, many of these people's lives have something to do with death, too. I don't think that's a coincidence. You know, Jack Kevorkian, a proponent of euthanasia, Joan Hinton, you know, sort of accidentally invents a weapon of destruction. But I felt like there was a span of the late 20th century that was just getting captured over and over again, and it was like not so much focusing on the people, but seeing the world that these people lived in and helped to make in their own ways. You know, a model airplane builder who was the first to send a radio-controlled model airplane over the entire Atlantic Ocean at the age of 80-something.
Is that one of the songs here?
That was, yeah, that's the second song on the album.
Which song?
It's called The Little Airplane.
The Little Airplane.
Yeah.
6-inch wings in the kitchen, pulling up above the silverware. Little airplane taking the air now.
All of us are living, at every moment, we're sort of losing a particular generation of people. You know, and it's easy to sort of not be aware of that, but then you look back and you're like, 10 years ago, there were all these people who lived through the Depression who were just alive and well.
Mm.
And now today, you know, that number is a lot smaller. And it's sort of this invisible loss. And I found myself by mistake sort of falling in love with that loss.
I love the layering here, because you have the straight obit, you've got the musical sort of elegy on top of it. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the video, which sort of gives you this sort of archival quality. And it really does capture that feeling. When I read an obit, I'm constantly having the experience of, oh, that's the person who did that.
Mm-hmm.
Or, oh, so that's where that came from.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, who for 80 years was the president of blah, blah, blah company, you know, that made widgets.
Or the guy who invented the Dorito.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
He almost made it on the record.
Yeah. And he almost made it on the record.
Yeah. This close.
Not quite. There's not much that rhymes with Dorito, yeah. I guess. Something like that. Yeah. So you're walking a fine line here. I mean, the song The Freezer is really something that, you know, makes a song about a pretty horrible circumstance in human history.
It's true. And I've spent some time thinking about that, and, you know, whether it's possible to do anything after or in response to something as kind of unfathomably terrible as the Cambodian genocide, or any genocide, or any killing, really.
Well, let's see if it is possible. Okay. Let's listen to The Freezer.
I was a slim survivor in the land of the bone and skin. Just the husk of a painter when they lock the outside in.
That is pretty chilling, I have to say.
I didn't really have any intention of tackling anything as big as the Cambodian genocide. I mean, why would you try to write a pop song about that? It just sounds like a ridiculous exercise.
Have we taken everyone? Have we taken?
Felt really attracted to this guy, his story of, you know, growing up poor in the countryside, going to painting school, but then being forced to work to support his family, and then while he was working in a rice field in 1978, getting arrested for reasons that weren't disclosed to him, and being held in a prison camp for over a year under excruciatingly just kind of unspeakable conditions, seeing interrogations, seeing executions, and then, you know, strangely being liberated and devoting his life to documenting what had happened and to holding the perpetrators accountable and to making this really haunting, strangely affecting art that, in a way, was his only and best response to what happened to him.
Well, I have to say, you know, these are obits and homages without sentimentality, very simple, and in some sense, they have more power as a result of that.
Hmm. Thank you.
Yasha Hoffman is a songwriter who also writes the Scan column on science and the arts for the New York Times. His new album of songs composed from obituaries is called The Afterneath. Think about that.
So back to the world of the living. How did this year's election results affect you? Are the Democrats a dead man's party? What would you do to change the current state of politics? You've been talking about that. Here's some eternal wisdom from Irving, Texas, with help from the Rolling Stones. As the sage Mick Jagger once said, you can't always get what you want, but if you try, sometimes you just might get what you need. Is that a reference to the Keystone Pipeline there in Texas? Give us your view at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.